Blog Talk Radio.
This is Movie Geeks United. How's everyone out there doing tonight? Got a great casual show planned for you guys tonight. First of all, let us introduce ourselves. I am one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and the entire crew is here with me. We have Chris. Hello, Chris.
Word.
We have Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
And we have Aaron.
Good evening, fellas.
How's everybody doing tonight? It's good to have the whole family together.
Yes, the whole family.
Pass the turkey.
A pre-Easter get-together.
That's right.
Sounds good to me.
How's everything been going this week? Jerry, I know you see every movie ever released.
That's not true, and I wish you'd stop spreading that fallacy. You know, I really do. But I did see Semi-Pro, and I had an intestinal virus while watching it, but I already had come up with that before.
Now, Chris, you saw Semi-Pro too, didn't you?
No, I didn't, actually.
Oh, okay. Okay, you went to see Definitely Maybe. That was the one you saw last week.
Yeah.
Okay. So Jerry, what Semi-Pro on par with the rest of the Will Ferrell track or what?
No. It's on the one that is the one problem with the movie is Will Ferrell. He looks bored. He looks like he's phoning it in. And he's
really?
Just not, you know, it looks like, you know, he's been down this road a couple of times and he's just and it hurts the movie. There are some good things about the movie. But sadly, the main star of the show is like you say, lights on, no one home. Yeah.
But Woody Harrelson, you enjoyed him, right?
I like Woody, and he's all right in it. It's like everyone around Will is actually pretty funny, but the main star of the show just seems like he's phoning it in, and it hurts the rest of the movie.
Well, so many of the people around Will Ferrell in this movie, it's like an excursion for them.
Yeah,
it hasn't been the norm for them. And Will Ferrell, I mean, he's made so many movies in a row that are just just like is he counting down the different sports teams and different sports that he could
well
on?
Before this before the movie started, my brother and I were my brother said I wonder if he'll do a movie on football. Of course, 15 minutes into the movie, my brother turned to me and goes, you know, this is really awful. And, of course, afterwards, like, let's hope he doesn't do the football movie.
Yeah. It feels like he just needs to do it. And Stranger than Fiction, I actually really enjoy.
Oh, he could do more of those. I hope he does.
I really hope so, too.
I think he would have done the football film, but Clooney took it away from him.
Yeah, the Leatherheads movie that comes out in April.
Yeah, Leatherheads finally comes out, yeah.
It finally comes out, but I mean, you got to admit, Ferrell. I haven't seen the film, but Ferrell has—he is smart enough to surround himself with good people. I mean, we got Andre Benjamin, who I think is an underrated actor. My hometown boy, Jackie Earle Haley.
He's actually really funny in it, Aaron. He's his parts in it that he's in. You're like, oh my god.
Well, it's funny. A buddy of mine went out to dinner with him, Jackie, last Monday. He was in town. He'd just come in from finishing. He had finished Watchmen and. You know, he's going to be in the Scorsese film, and so they were catching up. And so they were going to go see Semi-Pro because actually Jackie hadn't seen it yet. So it was going to be his first time seeing it.
Mm.
So he had a lot of fun, though, doing it.
Yeah, it seems like, plus, that a lot of these higher-caliber actors, like Woody Harrelson and a couple here and there, they do these movies because they want to be in something popular. I mean, first of all, do you get that sense?
Yeah.
They want to know what it's like to do a movie that's actually the kind of movie today that sells out. And sells out in more ways than one.
Yeah.
I think Woody Harrelson, First of all, Woody Harrelson is one of my favorite actors.
That's what I'm saying. He's a higher caliber actor.
I'll see anything he does, but I think Woody Harrelson, it's not as calculated as that. I think he will do something that's kind of a mass appeal entertainment.
Well, he started out in mass appeal entertainment.
Cheers.
Yeah.
I mean, he'll get more mass appeal than Cheers. So that is his, you know, that is where he comes from. But he does that now, I think, to offset kind of the more the indie or the quirky, the supporter. I mean, let's not forget.
But hasn't mass appeal entertainment dumbed down somewhat since White Men Can't Jump?
No, I mean, look at it.
I don't know about that.
I don't think so either. Go back and watch Cheers. It wasn't that great.
I mean, Cheers, the first few seasons, the Shelley Long coach years of Cheers, I think, still hold up. You know, this is nothing new, the spring sports comedy. I mean, you know, 92, you know, you bring up White Man Can't Jump, you know, that was also around this time in 1992, but what was also around this time in 1992 was The Cutting Edge.
That's right.
You know, Maura Kelly and D.B. Sweeney. I mean, so, and,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, but that's not, you know, parade around in the street with my underwear to get a laugh. I mean,
but it's still one of these formula sports comedy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We can argue the value or the quality, but the fact is, spring sports comedy scene, it's nothing new.
Aaron's right, but also this film is missing something very funny. And one of the things that stood out, Blades of Glory, the thing that really surprised me about that was Amy Poehler, which I thought was like a breakout role for her as far as movies go. She stole that movie, and she's sort of sadly missing from this. You could always, you know, you realize, wow, you really miss Amy.
Well, I will say this, and I think...
Once in love with Amy.
I think Jerry would agree with me in that the women of the current SNL women, Amy Poehler, former Tina Fey, and also Kristen Wiig and Rachel Dratch and I will put those group of women up against any other years, you know, generations of the women on SNL. I think it's actually the strongest women SNL has had in the history of the show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think for a long time. I mean, the only one I'm probably going to say is obviously the first generation of Jane Curtin and Gilda Radner. But otherwise, you have an incredibly strong case right there.
Well, I would even say they're stronger than those, and not only by default in that, you know, if you've ever read the Live from New York.
Yes, I have.
Those girls, you know, the Jane Curtin and Gilda Radner, they had to fight tooth and nail to get even one skit, and now, you know, Tina Fey was the first head writer. I think the women have actually come out to be even stronger than the men.
Yeah, Tina Fey did a lot for that.
Mm-hmm.
There's something interesting going on with SNL right now, though. And maybe peripherally it's always kind of been this way here and there. But last week, or last night, rather, Hillary Clinton showed up on the opening scene.
Yes, she did.
Scene.
That's right.
Yeah. And then Barack's been on the show before, too, leading up to this campaign. Is that, does that help? Chris, do you think that has any kind of, do they see them as regular, normal people that can laugh at themselves? Do you think that factors into the campaign at all? Or do you think that SNL still holds that kind of clout to be able to influence?
I don't think that SNL holds that kind of clout. I mean, I think people watch it. You know, I watched it, and when Barack came on, you know, before the strike, I said,
Halloween
Barack Obama. And then I forgot about it, you know. And it's the same with Hillary Clinton last night. It's like, they made fun of her last week. She came on. She was a really good sport, you know, but I forgot about it. So I find it hard to believe that people take that into consideration when they're casting their
vote. So you think it's a stronger case that we look at them and think, who can better lead the country, and that's our deciding factor over how good are they on SNL?
No, actually, there's a point to be made about Hillary's appearance.
She leaves Texas.
Mm-hmm.
She's nowhere to be found because she's flying to New York
to do this. It's a very calculated move on her part. I mean, they were making fun of it on Huffington Post before, like, 10 o'clock last night. It was when I read about it, and they said she's probably going to be on SNL. And, you know, it was very cynical, all the postings about it before she was on. So it was just like almost, it was like she was almost behind the curve. It seemed like a desperate move on her part to do this.
Does SNL really play well in Texas? I mean, is it like...
Yes. I mean, what are you talking about? I mean, it plays well in America. I mean, it's an American institution. I mean, you know, Texas is not no country. That's just part of Texas. Texas is, there's urban sprawl in Texas. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's a metropolitan, there's metropolitan area like there is in any other part of the Southwest. And as far as this all goes back, this is nothing new. Again, this all goes back to Clinton. Before Clinton.
On Arsenio.
On Arsenio. Before that, it was a very risky, and it was very looked down upon when
mm-hmm.
a politician showed up on any talk show, particularly a president. They didn't show up until after they left the office. Then they would
right.
go to Carson. But when with Bill Clinton, and this is something that he doesn't get as much credit as he deserved, when they talk about energizing the youth, you know, that Obama gets, Clinton did that first, and going to Arsenio was a major point in that campaign, to the point that every election cycle since 2 and 4 years,
right.
politicians go on talk shows now. It is now part of their schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank God for them, too, because after the writer's strike, I mean, that's all they could get, basically.
Yeah.
or during the writer's strike.
So it's part of their schedule to go on talk shows, and even the bigger guns, whether it's the president or, you know, major senators, you know, Schwarzenegger, it is their, they really want to, if they're having some bad press of any kind, then if they go on SNL, that kind of
proves that they have a sense of humor about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, proves they have a sense of humor. I mean,
yeah.
So I mean, I was actually surprised. I'm not as cynical as they are in the Huffington Post. I was surprised, and when it came up, I was pleasantly surprised. And I thought it worked very well.
I thought she did a good job.
She did a good job. Giuliani, who I'm not a big fan of, I thought he was a little stiffer on his. Later on in the weekend update, I will say the next to Hillary, the best surprise, which I thought was truly hysterical, was Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah, he was out of the blue.
Hillary can make fun of herself, but when D'Onofrio actually showed that he could poke fun at that image, to me, that was the real
mm-hmm.
highlight of that thing.
You're right.
What image was D'Onofrio poking fun of?
He was poking fun of his. Criminal intent image.
Yeah, his Law and Order.
You know, his law where he gets in their face and he, you know, breathes on them and he's just kind of overbearing and, you know, he poked fun at that and I think that got a bigger laugh than the Hillary thing.
I'd actually like to see that. I'd like to see Vincent D'Onofrio make fun of himself now. He's built a career out of overacting.
Yeah, I mean, and it's terrific. And he does, and once in D'Onofrio being a true great actor. He doesn't break character.
That's true.
But Chris and I are in agreement about this. Chris, I mean, we both found tremendous promise with Vincent D'Onofrio, but hasn't he fallen prey of like he's got to give every character he plays so many ticks and that it enters a realm of like parody almost.
I recognize, we have talked about this before, and I do recognize what you're talking about. He does do that, but I just. Find that I love him so much.
Yeah.
He does it in the same way that Jeff Goldblum does it. You know?
Yeah.
Or Christopher Walken.
Or Chris Walken does, although Chris Walken's a little bit too much into self-parody now. Enough already with the SNL movies, and I get it. You're
Balls of Fury.
I see him in something like The Breakup, and I just, I'm like, is this a real person? And
yeah, but no,
him.
The Breakup is actually, for him, he was the highlight of that movie.
Oh, God.
He was the highlight, and he was making fun of that intense persona that he carries. I thought he was the one bright spot of the breakup.
And all,
he was
and all
good in Thumbsucker. Yeah. I thought he did a pretty.
I thought it was
oh,
good.
Oh, he's great in that.
And all D'Onofrio has to do, like Walken, who is a little bit in the parody right now, but all D'Onofrio has to do is do something like Catch Me If You Can, like Walken did and you know people are like, oh, okay, D'Onofrio can, you know, they will be reminded. But
yeah,
yeah.
He just can't put on another 60 pounds this time because then we're going to be in Marlon Brando territory.
I just don't see that he plays things truthful, really. You know,
I don't think he ever lost weight from Full Metal Jacket. It never seemed like he ever really lost weight from Full Metal Jacket.
That's exactly what I meant. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I want to announce before we get into DVDs a couple of our future shows.
Let's announce the big one.
You want to announce the big one?
Let's announce the big one.
I was going to lead up to the big one, dude.
Everyone, a lot of people know, but all right, okay, you do it your way. Okay.
Okay. On the 12th, we have author Denise Mann, and she has written a book called Hollywood Independence, The Post-War Talent Takeover. And it's about how the filmmaking climate kind of changed after the decline of the studios and the rise of TV, and then talents like Joseph Mankiewicz and Elia Kazan and Billy Wilder kind of took over. And then on the 23rd, in celebration of the new Bonnie and Clyde special edition DVD and a new book called what is Mark Harris's new book called? It's
Pictures at a Revolution.
Pictures at a Revolution.
Yeah.
A 5 nominated film and the birth of the new Hollywood.
And Mark Harris is, of course, he's a frequent Entertainment Weekly contributor, and he is the author of this book. And it was a fascinating race for Best Picture that year, and it said a lot about the culture at large, too. And so we're going to be discussing that with him, and plus reviewing the new Bonnie and Clyde DVD. And then the next Sunday, on the 30th, we just booked a big one, a big guest, and it's legendary writer-director Paul Schrader. And that's a massive
and film
right
critic Paul Schrader, former film critic Paul Schrader.
Yeah, he started out as a film critic, but I mean, you look at his work, you look at his body of work, writing some of the best Scorsese movies ever made, like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Last Temptation, Bringing Out the Dead, directing, writing and directing American Gigolo, Blue Collar, Hardcore, on and on and on, Affliction, and he has 2 movies, one of which just got released in theaters called The Walker with Woody Harrelson, and another awaiting release called Adam Resurrected with Jeff Goldblum and Willem Dafoe. I think Willem Dafoe's in that one too. Amazing, intense talent. I mean,
yeah, oh yeah.
A resume of timeless movies and uncompromising movies too. So, and the Wednesday prior to that, we'll be reviewing between all the movie geeks his career, his resume of great films, to give all our listeners out there, in case you can benefit from it, a primer on Mr. Schrader's career. It should be a great month, particularly near the end of the month here.
It is also interesting to note, I don't know how new the site is, but I just found a link that there is a site called paulschrader.org.
Yeah, that's his official website that just started last week.
Yes, yeah, it started last week, and it has links to all of his writings as a film critic. And one of them, and it's a real fascinating read, from 1969, is his Pan review, his negative review of Easy Rider, which apparently got him in trouble because he did not go along with the status quo counterculture, thinking that it was a great moment of movies, and he said it wasn't that good. So that might be something we can talk to him about, and I think there's going to be a lot of stuff just on film criticism. If we get into his career on that particular review and Kale, and then some of the people he's worked with, Richard Pryor, and Bruce,
yeah.
I mean, the guy's worked with, I mean, how many people can you say you've worked with? Richard Pryor, Willem Dafoe, Robert De Niro, Scorsese, and Bruce Springsteen and Joan Jett.
Right.
Pauly Shore, right?
Actually, the first two David Lynch has worked with, the first two. Richard Pryor and Willem Dafoe.
Right. What was it? Lost Highway, obviously. But do we really want to talk about... Well, when that comes out on DVD, we can have a nice discussion on... Which a special edition DVD is coming soon. And so when that comes, I'm sure we'll have a nice...
Of which one?
Of Lost Highway.
Who's releasing that? Who's...
Universal.
Oh, okay.
With a... From what I read in the description, a 10-part multi-angle discussion / documentary about Lost Highway. I have no idea what a multi-angle documentary consists of regarding Lost Highway, but I'm sure it'll be... Something tells me the discussion on the DVD will be more interesting than the actual film, but that's just me. So, but I'm sure we'll get into that when it comes out later in the month.
Okay, can't wait.
I can't, but anyway, go on.
So, Chris, have you seen... we're going to be talking about, some of these DVDs that have come out that are coming out in the next month. Did you want to stick around for this? Did you have any of these that you'd seen? Do you feel like you can?
No, you know what? I haven't seen any of these movies, and Into the Wild in particular, I haven't gotten to see yet. So I kind of don't want to be a part of talking about that.
But,
I don't want it to be ruined for me at all.
Well, we'll get to that in
Chris.
A little bit, but I do want Chris to stick around because I do have a discussion. I do have a particular question that I have about an aspect of the first DVD we're going to talk to, and I want to get everyone's input on it, which is more of a technical question. I think Chris might have something to say.
Okay, well, let's get into this first topic then.
Okay. The first topic, the DVD we're going to talk about, is it just came out this past Tuesday, and that is the 4-disc Criterion edition of The Last Emperor, which we all know Bernardo Bertolucci won Best Picture, I believe won 8 Academy Awards. And so this is going to be one of the highlights of the Criterion, you know, the Criterion calendar this year. I mean, it's already February, and this is one of their big releases. Four discs. Basically, it's the final word on everything on the last set that can be said on The Last Emperor, or is it? But I'll get to that in a minute. Just to break it down, you know, The Last Emperor is a pretty remarkable film, just on a physical scale, in that it chronicles the last emperor of China, Puyi, who was anointed emperor at age 3, and then while he was still a child, was Cultural Revolution came, and he was banished and became a peasant, and then became a prisoner, and then westernized, and we see a whole his whole arc throughout this whole film, from child to kind of a spoiled kid who sheltered in the Forbidden City to a humble person by the end. And it was the first film permitted, Western film permitted in China that was got cooperation by the Chinese government since, I believe, 1949, and they actually shot within the Forbidden City, and Bertolucci just pulled out, you know, all the stops for the mounting of, just the mounting of the physical production. And so this DVD really celebrates that. It's a 4-disc collection. The disc one is the theatrical cut of the film, which is 165 minutes. Disc two, and I must make this very clear, is the television version of this film, which by contract they were supposed they were contractually bound to have 50-minute episodes, 4 50-minute episodes. So this TV version runs a little like 216 minutes or 14 minutes around there, and it's the TV version. But Bertolucci has stated, made it very clear, that he does not consider it a director's cut. He prefers the theatrical version, and that's the one he wanted, that's the one he had released, but by contractually he had to deliver this longer version. So it's not a director's cut, but Criterion, wanting to provide everything that is possible, they are offering it as a second disc, known as the TV version of it. And what's funny is that when this was first shown, I believe around 1998, we got a limited release, and Artisan put out the DVD. A lot of critics came out saying they preferred the TV version to the film just because it was so much more in-depth and so forth. I actually have not finished doing a, you know, watching these back-to-back, so I will not rule judgment, but, you know, some people have said there's such a thing as too much of a good thing, and some people just like every bit of it. So I think it's depending on your taste. It's not the same as Apocalypse versus Apocalypse Redux, where Coppola has stated that he prefers Redux to the other one, and so there we can really get into a debate of which one's better. Then the last two discs are all the copious extras, documentaries with Bertolucci and the making of the film and of Chinese culture and history. I think the highlight for me anyways is on disc four, and that's a 25-minute, almost 30-minute interview with composer David Byrne.
Wow.
That
was a bold choice, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was at the time.
Yeah, I'm a huge Talking Head. I don't know anyone else on this on the panel here that's diehard Talking Heads fan, but I am a...
I'm a diehard David Byrne solo fan. I mean, I like Talking Heads, obviously.
I love Talking Heads, yeah.
But I have most of his solo albums. I love them. And he also composes the music for Big Love, of all things.
Big Love,
too.
Yes. Big Love is in the score. The music of the second season is where it really started to shine.
Yeah, yeah.
And his solo work is terrific. The album from 2001, I believe, Through the Glass Eye or Through the Looking Eye, something like that, is a great album, with the song like People Like Humans Do. It's a great pop song. I actually saw him in Vegas in August of 2001, and the guy puts on a dynamic show. And of course, like I said, I love everything they're talking about. I have all their records.
Well, that's akin to the Scorsese's choice of Peter Gabriel for Last Temptation of Christ.
Yes, I mean,
and they both work so beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
I have to go back, but I'm sure in the intellectual world music circles, I'm sure there is a kind of a West Coast, East Coast rivalry between if you were a Byrne person or a Peter Gabriel person. I'm sure there was some heated arguments, maybe some gunfire over who was better.
Right.
You know, but Talking Heads, to me, they had more, I mean, cause they just, I love their evolution from funk to pop to disco to just world beat to just great pop. And Stop Making Sense, as much as I love other concert films, but as a purely conceived concert movie, Stop Making Sense to me is still the best concert film ever made. There are other films that are different for different genres, whether it's Give Me Shelter, The Last Waltz, or even Woodstock, but they have different purposes. But as a purely executed concert movie, Stop Making Sense is just one of the great movie-going experiences. But anyway,
I agree. But back
I
got
to tell you, I always felt that Burning Down the House felt like it was totally out of place in Last Emperor. Really, really inappropriate.
But what was
a man is going to slit his wrists. That's not the song he'd be listening to.
No, what was more appropriate was Life During Wartime. But so it was a bold move for David Byrne, who was still a member of the Talking Heads, to be asked to compose this film. But then again, if you were listening to Talking Heads records at that time, particularly the last two records, which was True Stories, the soundtrack to True Stories, and particularly their last album, Naked, it wasn't such a crazy idea for David Byrne to be asked to come in. And he tells the story that really Bertolucci was in, they were in Florence. Demme and Byrne were in Florence showing Stop Making Sense. This is around 1984, early 85, I think. And of course, the audience went nuts. They're dancing in the aisles, and they're clapping and cheering. And it's like a concert, almost like a real live concert. And Bertolucci said, "Well, I wish one of my movies could do this." And so from then on, he always remembered David Byrne. And so when he was making this movie, he thought of him to compose part of the score, because Byrne does part of the score, and the other composer, Rhea Weeksy, does the other half of the score, and they both mesh. And I don't, from what I gather in the interview, they weren't in the same room when they were composing. So
It's a great theme, though.
Well, Byrne is actually responsible, oddly enough, ironically enough, for the more Asian influenced part of the score, where Rhea Weeksy does the more orchestral Western part of the score.
I mean,
a lot of people assumed it was the other way around, but it wasn't. And so to me, the highlight, just because I'm such a Byrne fan, is this interview where he's talking about the influence, how he asked for a bunch of music from China while they're in production. They sent him this box of cassettes, and he just soaked it all in, and then he didn't go back to it, and all the influences. So as you can tell, they cover pretty much every aspect of the film, to location scouting and Bertolucci's Polaroids, and even the book, the usual Criterion booklet that comes with the film is like, I believe, 86 pages. So it's one of their one of their thicker books that they've ever.
This is a tentpole release for them, and then,
yeah, this is a tentpole.
So this is like what we love Criterion for. This represents that kind of set.
Now, having said all that and praising it to the hilt, there is controversy over this release, and let me see if I can explain it. The cinematographer for Last Emperor was Vittorio Storaro, and we all will agree Vittorio Storaro is one of the masters. Conformist, 1900,
right.
Reds, Apocalypse Now, Dick Tracy, can't say a bad thing about him. I will in a minute, though.
Oh, shit.
What he has this belief, and it's possibly true, that, and this was starting around 10 years ago when DVDs were coming out, that the 2:3, he shoots everything in widescreen, 2:3:5:1, which for our listeners who don't know, that means width to height, 2:1, width to height. So that's why, movies, when they're formatted in a rectangle, not the square, which is a normal television. But now with the advent of widescreen TVs and HD, that's also becoming obsolete. But he felt, this is around 10 years ago, that when you transferred, even the best transfers of 2:3:5 aspect ratio in films, that best televisions were not giving you the optimum image quality. So he took it upon himself to reformat these films to a 2:1 ratio, 2:1. So it's zoomed in it's still, you know, the black bars are not as thick, so he zooms in, so that way when it's transferred and it's shown on television, you will get a better, he feels a better quality picture. Now, he did this with Apocalypse Now, Redux DVD, so that is not the widescreen theatrical presentation, and I believe, and from what I've read, he also did this with Warren Beatty's Reds, and so now he's done with The Last Emperor, and finally, it seems like the movie, you know, the movie buff DVD collector community has snapped back in saying that while this is a noble gesture and idea, that by doing this, that maybe 10 years ago this might have been a good idea, but now that the quickly becoming the norm is widescreen televisions and HD televisions, that this concern seems less and less problematic. And so there's a lot of complaining that Serraro is doing this, and over on, and particularly on DVDBeaver.com, which is a real website, not porn, they actually have some screen grabs from earlier DVDs, which were 235 and the Criterion one, and they are illustrating what is cropped off. You know, people are either bunched up, or maybe they're missing their shoulders quite a bit, or half of their body, because of the zooming in that Storaro has done for proclaiming for preservation of the best image quality.
But you're talking about the guy that shot the movie overseeing the transfer, and so the implication is that he's sabotaging his own work somehow.
Well, that is, I mean, that could be one way of reading it, but this is coming from Storaro himself. He says, I am doing this myself, and he's getting the blessing from the directors. He goes, I know what I shot, but I want the optimum, you know, the best quality image. So I am redoing the whole film, basically, and giving you the same information, but I am focusing it more. I am tightening the focus for you, but I'm making sure you are not losing anything that I shot originally. I get the feeling.
Who is it that has a problem with this?
That's what I don't understand. Who has a problem with
it? Who can really say if the director is blessing it and the cinematographer is blessing it,
But, I mean, okay, but we all can agree that Apocalypse Now is a widescreen experience. And so when it's being reformatted, you are missing. It is estimated that about 30% of the image is being lost, if you will, with Storaro's concern of image quality. And that is quite significant. I get the feeling, and Bertolucci has not said anything, but I get the feeling that Storaro is such held in high regard that these directors, Coppola, Bertolucci, Beatty, are trusting him, you know, almost blindly, and saying, you know what, if Storaro says this is the best way, then we'll do it. I feel that this, while this might have been a legitimate concern of Storaro's 10 years ago, I do feel that with the advent and the rapid popularity and purchasing of widescreen televisions and high-def television, that I feel, and this is just my gut feeling, that this is not as big a concern as it would have been 10 years ago. And let's face it, the people who can afford the four-disc Criterion Edition are not the people with the 27-inch TVs. That's a general assumption, but I'm going to stick with it, that the people who are going to collect the Criterion four-disc $60, $70 box...
Is that how much it's going for? Is that...
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, $60, $70.
Okay, all right.
So, I mean, you know, that is a good chunk of change on one movie.
Yeah.
So those people who are buying it, they're the ones with the high-end...
They're purists.
Purists, and they're the ones with the high-end gear. So let it be known that films like The Conformist, The 1900, which have come out on DVD, have not been reformatted. And those were also Storaro and Bertolucci.
I mean, I don't know how far we can take this argument, really. What interests me, though... And talking about widescreen, remember when widescreen first started popping up and everyone was so bitterly opposed to it, you know, like the regular mom and pop on the couch.
Right, yeah, they were.
You know, and now it's just become a thing, you know, it is the standard way of watching a film, with those black bars on the top and the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But it took forever to convince people,
Yeah, but it's, they still, you still haven't convinced people because they still produce, mass produce,
a full screen version.
A full screen version, because there are some people that still get angry about the widescreen. Now, I'm the exact opposite. I get angry, you know, if I get a gift and it's full screen, I smile and I'm like, ooh, and then I, you know, the day after Christmas, I'm heading to Best Buy, you know, without it opened. They're like, open it up. I'm like, yeah, I'll open it later, you know, and I, the next day I'm at Best Buy exchanging it for the widescreen version.
Mm-hmm.
So, frankly, I don't know. This argument seems, I got to say, it seems a little silly.
Yeah.
It's either widescreen or it's full screen. If it's widescreen and the cinematographer has, you know, re-clipped it and zoomed it in and, you know, to get a tighter image, but it's still a widescreen, you know, I'll take that. I don't care if I'm missing, you know, half of a phone booth on the outside of the screen or,
that's true,
or somebody's shoulder, you know. I just want it to be widescreen. I don't want it to be, you know, taking up the whole screen and do that silly pan and scan thing they do on TV.
That's awful. Terrible.
That's the
why did Cameron go to that? Wasn't it Cameron that used to do that early on in the DVD phase? He'd do the pan and scans instead of widescreen?
I have no idea who.
I think it was.
He did that on Titanic. That's why he would shoot in an open Super 35. He would shoot fully open Super 35 because he knew when it was going to tape back then, he could readjust. And I believe in Scorsese did the same thing with Cape Fear, which was his first widescreen film. What is interesting to note here, and I have a widescreen television, I believe 42 monitor, that it is funny that the black bars really do not come present.
Right.
On DVDs, widescreen DVDs, until 235. Even 185, the black bars are super minimal.
Right.
I don't know what kind of TVs we all are dealing with here, but 185 is almost like norm now with on widescreen high-def televisions. 185 is norm. The same thing with, you know, it used to be television was 133. Now television really is 178. You know, going back to, you know, basically this started with The Sopranos.
James in the chat room says that Cameron actually had a good bonus feature on the T2 disc. I'm wondering which 10 versions of the T2 disc this showed up in, but showing the widescreen versus the pan and scan side by side. Yeah, every director has their little, you know, their little quirks and what they want to stand by.
Right.
I think Storaro is giving a little too much freedom because this is... The format was chosen 235, and so that should be what it should be exhibited in. And I think Storaro, being Storaro, is giving a little too much credit. Let us not forget Storaro also lensed Ishtar, so the man is not infallible.
Well, we all make mistakes, you know.
But I gotta say,
there's a little part of me that, and I don't mean this as an offense to anyone, but there's a little part of me, because Last Emperor, while I think that it's a good movie, it's not a movie that most Americans love. It, the general audiences,
yeah,
they might remember it, but it's not something that you find in a lot of people. You go to 10 houses and look at their DVD collection, you're probably not going to find Last Emperor in any of them.
That's true.
So there's this little tiny part of me that, you know, the guys out there that do go out and buy the 4-disc Criterion version of Last Emperor for $70 and then get angry about the fact that it's slightly, you know, changed.
Yeah, if you're buying, if you're investing that much change.
There's a little part of me that's happy that they're angry about
it. Yeah.
Well,
I know what you're saying, man.
Chris, I understand, baby.
You know, I think that The Last Emperor is an important film because, but you're right. It's not like the regular kind of viewing audience is going to necessarily gravitate towards that title. But like Kurosawa's Ron, it's the last time you're likely to see that kind of real grandiose film put together without the usage of computers. I mean, it's practical. I mean, all that crap is practical.
Yeah,
I'm not knocking the movie. I do.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. It's like you mispronounce a Borg's name in Star Trek, and everybody, that whole community,
right, yeah,
gets on your
now,
case.
It's the last good performance by John Lone. I mean, it's a great film.
Yeah,
it's really a great film.
And you may have a point there, Chris, about, you know, it's not a mass appeal, you know, Academy Award winner. But once again, this goes back to the other point I made, that the people who are buying it,
yeah,
are the ones who are aware of aspect ratios. So I do think it does go hand in hand. I will say this, and I think Spielberg has done the right thing. I read somewhere that Spielberg said in an interview that you know, he now shoots 185. I don't know if y'all have noticed this, that he's pretty much a 185 guy now. He used to be, obviously, a widescreen. I'm trying to remember. I'm guessing Jurassic Park might have been his last 235. Whether it's Jurassic Park 1 or 2, I don't remember. But I think Schindler's List was 185, and then all the recent ones, Minority Report and Munich and Private Ryan are 185. And I believe someone asked him, like, why did you go to 185 now? And he says, this is interesting, he goes, I chose 185 because when transferred for television, it transfers the best, quality-wise.
Yeah.
So Spielberg has gone that extra mile to think ahead. It's like, look, when this stuff gets shown on television and DVD, the best quality for the transfer is 185.
So and you know what? You got to think about that now because more people are going to see it on DVD than see it theatrically. You know, most movies.
So I think Spielberg has gone that extra mile to think ahead, and therefore not having to worry about this Univision that Storaro has sort of coined about this 235 because. I mean, Spielberg hasn't gone back and reformatted Jaws or Indiana Jones.
Right,
and you would
think,
you know, and it's funny, someone as picky as, just off the top of my head, as picky as George Lucas.
Don't give him any ideas.
With any input. The man has not gone back to reformat any of the Star Wars films.
Don't give him any ideas.
Well, see,
stop it. Just stop it, Aaron.
I don't think he would.
He's listening.
George Lucas ain't listening. One of his 20 assistants might be.
You know, he hasn't moved. He hasn't gone back. But you know, at the same token, George Lucas as a filmmaker hasn't really gone forward either. as a storyteller,
There's a whole.
Hey, James brought up a good point.
He's talking about the Coen brothers in there, isn't he?
Yeah, we're talking about the Coen brothers and My Fargo Snow Globe. But Janusz Kaminski might have talked Spielberg into that. Is that
That wouldn't surprise me.
Good point, James. Very good.
Because it coincides with when they started working together,
yeah.
I guess, that decision. No, we got to get off Last Emperor. But just to let James know, next week, actually, we're going to be reviewing the No Country for Old Men disc days before it's available in the stores. Isn't that exciting?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. I can't wait to hear. Is there anything, do you think there are any special features on it? Or
there are a couple, and we'll get into this next week, but I get the feeling, now that the Coen brothers are actually a Best Picture winner,
yeah.
That I'm pretty sure either in the Blu-ray edition or in the two-year anniversary edition, we're going to get finally that, you know, a deluxe Coen Brothers edition of a film that we've always wanted because they've never been very particular in doing DVDs.
Right.
You know what I'd love to see? I'd love to see, you know how a couple of discs did this. The Jerry Maguire special edition disc, they had a separate video screen showing the cast watching
right.
the movie with you. I'd like that for Big Lebowski.
Oh, that'd be great.
Well, that'd be great fun.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Joel and Ethan Coen would just be kind of giggling in the corner.
Yeah, but you'd watch it for Bridges and all the others anyway. You wouldn't watch it for, you know, necessarily the Coen brothers themselves.
Yeah, I mean, they did do a commentary, and while I love them and I like listening to it, it's not the greatest commentary in the world. We've talked about this before. There's some directors, for whatever reason, are better at doing commentary
yeah,
than
I mean,
others,
I think
not necessarily the best director.
Billy Bob Thornton, I believe, if I remember correctly, he did a lot of the heavy lifting on that commentary.
Right.
And he's actually
yeah.
a better commentator than most. Surprisingly.
Yeah, I like him. I like him.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on to some other titles. We've got a few minutes. We'll probably go a little over tonight. But Chris, if you want to step out any time, but I'm sure you have something to say about Bobby Deerfield. So.
I haven't seen that in a long time.
Let's go to whatever you want to go to next, Aaron.
All right. Well, I guess we can tackle these two films together, Bobby Deerfield and Injustice for All, and we'll be able to tell which one we prefer.
My man, Al Pacino.
Of these
films. I didn't know that, Jamie. I had no idea.
Now, Bobby Deerfield is 77, and Injustice for All is 79, and Cruising is 80. And then Author is 82, and Scarface is 83, and Revolution is 85. So from about 1977 to about 1985, and I think Jamie is pretty much in agreement, this is considered Pacino's no man's land period. Now, obviously, Scarface is the one exception, but that's an exception now. As to when it first came out, then it was also considered, you know, another string in Pacino's, you know, overacting or bad
right.
performance.
Right. You bring up a very good point there.
No. I mean, I think Scarface has endured and it's grown in reputation, but it was still the second highest grossing film that year behind Jedi.
Yeah. I'd like to say something about Arthur.
I actually like Arthur. I read a commentator on a message board who said he considered Arthur Pacino's Bad News Bears. And that was like the best description of Arthur I'd ever heard.
Well, when we saw the trailer, I guess it was the trailer was in front of Death Trap, and I didn't know much about Al Pacino at the time, but my parents saw the trailer and they were like shocked that Pacino was in a comedy.
Yeah.
Because it was just so, it was unheard of at that time.
Yeah.
I think he works in it, you know.
I think
that the film is a very mild family comedy drama that doesn't really, you know, it holds up. It is what it is. It's something that you watch on Sunday on the cable station, you know.
It must be a relief to do a part like that too after doing so many intense performances.
That's just it. And each of these missteps, I can see why Pacino chose it for himself.
Yeah.
But what's most amazing about Arthur is what he did next, which was Scarface.
Yeah. I mean,
you want to see an actor's range?
Well,
there it is.
Well, we can tell why he did something so Section 180, because the film before that was Cruising, and so he felt the need, like, look, I need to do something
right
where I can just kind of breeze through. And he's very,
yeah,
very.
I'm not a homosexual. Look, I have a family of five. Yeah.
You know, Alan King is hysterical. Tuesday Weld is actually very good, and the kids.
So let's review the DVDs that we have.
Yeah, really.
Okay.
Yeah.
So but in the beginning of this No Man Land's period was Bobby Deerfield, was directed by Sidney Pollack, written by Alvin Sargent, and talk about a great screenwriter who also occasionally has a odd film on his resume, and he's a race car driver, and he falls in love, and doesn't go so well, and it's a very kind of introverted, quiet Pacino, and now it's kind of an interesting performance, but I understand back in 77 when the critics complained, he looked like he was bored and almost catatonic on screen, because he sort of is, but that's kind of a choice. And then in Justice for All, which was 2 years later, Pacino...
Now, Bobby Deerfield doesn't have any extras on it, does he?
Nothing. I mean, it gives you a free pass to 88 minutes. So, I mean,
right.
What the hell else more do you want?
Literally nothing.
Yeah. What more do you want? You guys
are cold-blooded, man.
God, Chris is asking for it.
You get a free pass, damn it.
Well, I just meant because you can't go see it.
Right. I know what you mean, man. And I've actually seen 88 minutes, and it's 88 minutes too long. You know, I personally didn't think much of 88 minutes. And I love Pacino, but there were no Pacino moments in there. Knowing a lot about Pacino, I feel equipped to talk about these two movies, Bobby Deerfield and Injustice for All. While Pacino had a dry streak, and that's part of why he left the business for, you know,
Four years. 85 is Revolution, 89 is Sea of Love.
Yeah, but Revolution, he finished shooting that before it came out. I mean, obviously. So there's a lot more time that he was off between the release of Revolution and the release of Sea of Love. But that time that he took off was valuable to him.
It was.
You talk about the dry streak, but talk about the streak that he started in the business with. I mean, unparalleled. The Two Godfathers, Dog Days, Serpico.
Panic.
Panic, Scarecrow, which is a great underappreciated movie. So he really came out of the gate strong. And so Misstep was just a matter of time. And why he chose Bobby Deerfield, he said that character felt the closest to him of anyone he's ever played. That kind of when celebrity cuts you off from the rest of the world, he found that in that character at that time. I think he depends on a director that he meshes with. He's completely dependent upon that collaboration. He needs that safety net. He and Sidney Pollack and Bobby Deerfield did not mesh. They actually didn't really get along. I think that might be some of the strangeness you feel of Pacino in that role. Like he doesn't quite find his footing. But, you know, the movie doesn't really either. Does it want to be a Disease of the Week movie? Does it want to be a movie about the race car driver, you know, his story? It doesn't really work as a film. It's pretty much a strange oddity just in Pacino's career to kind of look back on and say, well, it was odd. Especially when he tries to do, like, his Mae West impression. Which is one of the most awkward moments on screen. And he's very awkward in it, but in a kind of endearing kind of way. And Justice for All, however, was a movie that seemed like all the pieces were there. great writer, great director. They all got along very well. A great lead performance and a very the message of the film and the topic and themes of the film, very pertinent and relevant, and something that needed to be delved into deeper than previous films had. My problem, and I know, Aaron, you might have some different thoughts on it, my problem with the actual movie Injustice for All and why it didn't really take off is because it suffered from one too many of those subplots. I mean, it was too much already. It needed some cutting. It really did.
The problem to me is really the tone. And a lot of people at the time said, oh, it wants to be the network it wants to do for lawyers what network did for broadcasting. And that's actually incorrect. And Justice for All wants to be like, really, it's shift in tone. It wants to be like Catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
And Catch-22 is a very delicate film with its humor and then its, you know, very serious dramatic scenes. And it goes back and forth. And you more or less can stay with Catch-22. And Justice for All will have a very broad comedy sequence, like when Pacino and Jack Warden go flying.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it'll follow, like, three scenes in a row following that are deadly serious of, like,
rape, and, like, yeah.
You know, rape or injustice, you know, criminal injustice or, you know, miscarriages of justice or, you know, cruelty to other people.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The tonal shifts are just so out of whack. And part of that goes to Norman Jewison. You say a great director. I got to disagree in that Norman Jewison gets a lot of mileage because of, I guess, In the Heat of the Night, which is a terrific film, and we'll talk about that soon. And I love Moonstruck, and I'm a fan of Hurricane. But if you really look at his resume, Norman Jewison, for the most part, has a lot of misses. He's not a great, great filmmaker. He's a good filmmaker, and brings in stuff on budget, on time, and so he can constantly get work.
I think you hit it right on the head. That's it.
But other than Moonstruck,
well, he did Fiddler on the Roof too, didn't he?
He did Fiddler on the Roof, and that's fun.
So then you're talking about two. Best Picture winner.
Yeah.
I think that's where the legacy comes from more than
anything. Well, Fiddler on a Roof didn't win Best Picture.
Well, I look at his stuff. I look at the interviews with him and how he directs actors, and that's how I calibrate whether or not you're a great director. He talks about how he works with actors and what he does for them, and in that's what Pacino needs. That's a great director for Pacino.
Just not a great script. And this is another thing. Levinson... Also, kind of like Rob Reiner, it's kind of I guess you could say he bats about 50 when it comes to his screenplays. You know, for every Diner and Tin Man, you know, there's a Injustice for All or a High Anxiety.
Yeah.
So Levinson is just a pure screenwriter. It needed a Paddy Chayefsky or, you know, someone, you know, maybe not someone that big in caliber, but, you know, a Robert Towne or Derek Ponickson, you know, wrote the book The Last Detail, to really handle those, you know, those tonal shifts. And can we also agree, Jamie, that, you know, a lot of people talk about Sin of a Woman or Dick Tracy about when Pacino started doing that shouting every other word. Can we say actually it goes back to Injustice for All?
The scene where he beats up on the car.
Yeah.
The car. Or,
and
well,
when he
the
says,
final
you're out of order.
The final summation. He does.
Actually, the final summation is, if anyone remembers that movie at all, it's because of the final summation.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah.
That was.
And I think it's the final summation that got him an Oscar nomination for that movie.
But I.
So I mean, I, and you know, and I, Pacino's at a can't win place here because everybody equates him with being raising his voice and screaming everything. If he plays an angry, he might as well just not pick a script that has any angry scenes in it anymore.
Well,
he can't win.
When it's earned, it works very well.
Yeah, like Heat or Sin of a Woman or Dick Tracy. Well, let me ask you this, though. In 88 minutes, at any point, does he say, 5 minutes? Did he ever do that?
No.
Doesn't he shout the time?
No.
See, I'm not going then.
It's a very subdued performance, as I hear that the Righteous Kill is subdued. And we can't win. He can't win.
It's hard because when you get that stereotype.
Yeah, any critique of a Pacino performance starts with, you know, he tones down the hamminess.
Yeah.
He said that about Donnie Brasco.
He should have been nominated for that.
Yeah, he should have been.
But, you know,
Chris and I were talking about that. That's
sometimes
last
the ham is good. The rest, the recruit, he's terrific in with Colin Farrell. He has a lot of fun kind of poking fun of his hammy image.
Yeah.
But you know, I guess so.
It feels like you're alone there.
I guess.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a huge Roger Donaldson fan.
That new movie looks great. The Bank Job.
Yeah. I mean, I love Roger Donaldson. Going all the way back to Smash Palace.
Mm-hmm. Smash Palace. Yeah.
Smash Palace, yo, and Cocktail.
I think it's hysterical. Al Pacino still occasionally calls up Colin Farrell, and he's like, "Let's go out and have dinner." It's like, I want to keep connected with young people. And then like go out, they'll meet in New York and go out to eat. And he does that with a couple of his younger co-stars.
Colin Farrell, man, I know he'd show a good time.
I'm sure he knows many good times.
So I would.
Yeah, but how thrilling does that have to be for Colin Farrell too? I mean, just
go out with Pacino, yeah.
Yeah.
So Jamie, I guess since you are the Al Pacino number one fan here, I mean these. Let's face it. These two DVDs are really for the Pacino completists.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And Justice for All was available on DVD, prior.
Right.
So if you have that, this one has some documentaries on it. From Levinson speaks a lot about the script work and actually addresses that comedy versus drama mix.
He still seems a little testy. Don't you agree? He's still a little testy about that criticism.
Yeah, because I think you can't deny that it feels out of place at times.
Yeah.
I mean, his argument is that there was such absurdity that occurs in the legal system, and that they told it honestly. But then you have the plane scene, like you mentioned with Jack Warden, that you know, that's not something that's drawn from real... I guess it's drawn from some of these judges are so over the top in their behavior.
Yeah.
And they really play like caricatures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just
yeah.
One final note, that even though the film was made in 1979, so it was a true, you know, end of the 70s movie, it has, I gotta imagine, I was only 1 year old in 1979, but I gotta imagine, even in 1979, the disco tinge funk score that the film employed
right.
had to have been dated even in 1979.
Right. So. Yeah, I feel that way about a lot of movies of that era. But I think in the long run, Bobby Deerfield, I think, is a complete misfire. I think it's just to be gotten as kind of an oddity in Pacino's career. And Justice for All has moments that really work, and it just doesn't get there.
No,
you know?
Hey, Jamie.
Yeah.
There's a much better race car movie with Jeff Bridges from '73, The Last American Hero.
Yeah.
Which just came
See, that's
out
just it about Bobby Deerfield, though. It's not a race car movie.
No, but I know it's not a race car movie.
It's
like,
a disease of the week movie. That's what
yeah.
it turns out to be.
But I always thought The Last American Hero, I finally saw it a couple years ago when they re-released it on DVD, and it's just that's a really good movie.
That's another one of those lost, underrated Bridges early 70s performances
yeah.
in that city, and it's just terrific. It's funny you mentioned that Bobby Deerfield's Disease of the Week movie disguised as a race car movie. I remember as a kid thinking that Stroker Ace was a race car movie that should have been a Disease of the Week movie.
Okay, last titles. We got a couple minutes. We're going to run a little over. Just to remind people, we made an announcement at the top of the show that a big guest this month, the first one that we really confirmed for this month, Paul Schrader, March 30th, writer of Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, director of American Gigolo, Affliction, and so many classic films. It doesn't get better than that. So March 30th, Paul Schrader. Okay, go ahead with our last DVD picks.
Our last two, they're from Paramount, and one of them was just Oscar-nominated. Into the Wild is now coming out on DVD on Tuesday. It's a two-disc affair. One disc is just for the film, and the other disc is couple of the featurettes, and because the movie is still kind of, it's still in people's minds, it's not that old, I don't think there's much to say. I will say it is great to have Into the Wild on DVD again. Seeing it, I appreciate it even more. I remember when I saw it at the time, I was actually going through kind of a rough personal period, but I still, it was the first film I saw, and it is a remarkable film. I was telling Jamie, I think it was earlier in the week, that, you know, I've kind of been kind of hot and cold to Sean Penn as a director, you know, Crossing Guard and The Pledge and The Indian Runner. And, they've all had their fine dramatic moments, but they've also had those little affectations of Penn as a director, you know, little visual quirks,
yeah,
musical
yeah.
quirks, where Into the Wild is the first film, I think, as a director, it's his fourth film, where those, everything meshed.
Mm-hmm.
His affectations, his little quirks, visually putting lines from the book, the scroll across the screen, and the Eddie Vedder music, and just the scope of the film, it actually matched with the material, where before, something like In the Plague, which has its great moments, Mickey Rourke and so forth, tries for something greater than the material is ready to handle.
And so it just comes off pretentious
yeah.
in those other
yeah,
movies.
In moments. Where here
yeah.
in the Wild, to me, it's perfectly, it's all a perfect meshing of, you know, material and execution.
I think so, too. We reviewed this movie probably, like, last week.
Yeah, we did. We talked about it
last
show.
So I think the movie sells this disc. It's a two-disc special edition. So it's come out on the 4th or the 11th.
The 4th. Comes out
the 4th. The movie sells the disc. I would actually give the disc a lower rating than the movie because I felt like it's so much a movie about a journey. And as much as the journey of the lead character, the journey of the filmmakers, I don't think they gave as much to that as they should have in the extras, especially for a two-disc set.
Yeah.
I think it would have really benefited. There was a great Iconoclast episode that had Krakauer and Sean Penn taking that journey together.
At the very least, they could have put that on there. I mean, that's,
yeah.
you know, and that's an extra that they didn't have to worry about producing. They could have at least paid the licensing
right.
and gotten that. I don't know why. Like I said, my theory on a lot of these DVDs that are coming out this month that are just getting out of the Oscar campaign is that we're later, you know, a year later, we're going to get some double dips, and I think Into the Wild is one. I know for a fact, actually I don't know for a fact, but I can almost guarantee you, I will promise you anything, that we have not seen the best or definitive of Ridley Scott's American Gangster.
Really? Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay, now that's a good point. Is Into the Wild coming out on Blu-ray as well? Or?
No, just actually, I don't even know if it got suspended. It was announced as also an HD because it is a Paramount, so it was nominated as an HD DVD release. I don't know if they suspended the sale of those. So I'm assuming, but a Blu-ray is probably going to be somewhere in the future, and then
okay.
maybe that will be the super duper version.
That might be okay.
And the other title, which I like a little more than Jamie, I admit it's flawed. I admit, you know, it has problems, but I do think the dramatic moments are so good that I forgive kind of its dry patches, slow patches, and that's actually the movie Things We Lost in the Fire, which I think on the strength of Del Toro's performance and some actually good scenes by Halle Berry.
Right.
I do think it is worth seeing because it does have some real power to it. And Jamie also disagreed on this, but I do think it was a revelation for David Duchovny, who has a small role, but it was actually the first role I can think of in ages where it doesn't have quotation marks around it. It's not an ironic Duchovny performance. It's actually a genuinely sincere, sweet performance,
mm-hmm.
and it has to be for the dramatic stuff to work. Because the story is about she becomes widowed, he gets murdered in a senseless act of violence, and so we see in flashbacks their relationship. And I've always felt in these types of films where the husband or the wife dies in the first 10, 15 minutes, so they spend the first 10, 15 minutes establishing their relationship so you can feel something, 9 times out of 10, those establishing scenes rarely are enough.
Right.
Here, the flashbacks that deal with him are so well done that you do feel the loss. So I give Duchovny points for being able to convey that.
Now, Aaron, this is directed by the same person who did After the Wedding?
Is it? I think so.
Because that was nominated last year for Best Foreign Film. It's a great film.
Yeah, the thing about Things We Lost in the Fire is that before it was in production, an early draft of the script was one of these scripts that floated around Hollywood as, like, here's one of the 10 best unproduced scripts going around.
Oh, really? Okay.
And then the film came out and obviously didn't go anywhere. But from what I've heard from some insider friends is that what was filmed was not the script. They rearranged the script when they started filming. So it lost some of its momentum. And so it's kind of an interesting backstory on how what is a hot script going around as like as one of the great unproduced scripts of the year, when it's finally the director gets his hands on, they go and tinker with it to make it their own. Tinkering with it can kind of ruin your film.
Okay.
But I do think it is a good film. Like I said, I'm pretty sure Jamie is somewhat disagreeing with me.
It's in my Netflix queue, so I'm looking forward to it.
Jamie?
It's an average film. Mm-hmm. I think I agree with you that it only benefits from Del Toro's. The main draw here is Del Toro's performance. And I don't think that my personal opinion was that Duchovny wasn't a revelation. I thought he was refreshing. It was nice to see him again.
I like
it
him
just,
playing God.
It was just very odd to see him in this kind of movie.
I'm just trying to plan my day. Was my favorite line from Playing God. I love Playing God. Playing God is a true guilty pleasure. And seeing Playing God, that makes you realize, you know, Angelina Jolie doesn't mind doing some, you know, exploitation films if someone would ask her, because she's terrific in it.
No, she is. Yeah.
So yeah, so I would recommend Things We Lost in the Fire, but Jamie probably would differ. I think in the grand scheme of last year, particularly last fall, it was a lesser film. But I think if this was, you know, if we were back in the year 2000, which was probably the worst year of this decade, it would be one of the highlights. So,
but the two titles that we wholeheartedly recommend this week are The Last Emperor,
right,
and Into the Wild.
Those are the two recommendations without reservations. Like I said,
The Last Emperor is available now on DVD,
right,
and Into the Wild will be available on Tuesday.
And if anyone wants to buy The Last Emperor from me, I'll email you my address.
What are we in the classified section now? What are we?
I don't know. I just email. Anyone wants to buy it for me, please feel free.
Are we running a garage sale now?
Yeah, exactly.
And Justice for All and Bobby Deerfield also come out, I believe, on Tuesday also. And those are really just for your Pacino completists.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
If you're not into Pacino, a diehard Pacino fan, and you haven't seen these, you're not missing much.
There you go. Okay,
there you go,
that's our DVD releases for this week. Stay tuned to the blogs and the bulletins for future content. We're still, you know, it's a slow period now. We're struggling to get some of these interview slots filled this week. I think it's the calm before the storm, I think, is the good news. But stay tuned and find out when we air next, whether it be this Wednesday or next Sunday. We're not sure yet. But either way, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night, fellas.
Good night.
Thanks to all the listeners out there, too. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.